Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, March the 28th, 2024. This is episode 3470. And if I may, I'd like to pause for just a moment and mention that number again, 3470 episodes of the Survival Podcast. That means we're 30 episodes away from episode 3500. Now, I've done landmark episodes before. I think we did one at like 100, 500, 1000, and maybe 2500. I'm not sure. I'm not going to do any kind of a special episode for that, but I am going to acknowledge hitting 3500 episodes. When I started this show, I think, you know, early on, even when it became really successful, if you had asked anybody, including me, do you ever think there'll be over 3,000 episodes of the show? Most people would have said no, and I would have said, I don't know. I don't want to say there will be. I'd like there to be. And I think as you build something like TSPC has become over the years, and people just expect that these numbers will happen, it's still an accomplishment. It's still a lot of work. And I want to pause here not to pat myself on the back, but to thank you tuning in today, whether it's the first time or you've been around since the Jetta days, if you know what that even means, for helping me get here, for helping me get to 3,500 episodes, God willing. I mean, could get a meteor dropped on my house between now and then, but it looks like we will do that. And it just is kind of, round numbers for some reason have that impact. 3,500 episodes of the Survival Podcast, and thank you. Thank you for helping me. Thank you for supporting me. Thank you for sharing the show. Thank you to all of you who have been members or are currently members of the MSB. Thank you to those of you who do business with my sponsors, especially when you tell them that I'm why you did business with them. That's really important. Thank you when you use my links to make purchases through Amazon and Vivor. All of that is why I'm able to do this. And thank you to all of you recently who have express confidence in me by taking some of the courses at Home Food Systems that we're putting out, and we will keep doing that as well. Anyway, with that in mind, let's go ahead and tell you what we're going to talk about today. Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini in the Ron Paul Liberty Reports will answer a question. What kind of nation allows itself to be invaded? I haven't listened to this one yet. I'm going to listen to it on the fly as I build the show out for you today, and then I'll give you some thoughts on it. But I will give you my short answer right up front. A really stupid one. That's my answer. And I'm going to say a little bit about this whole, like, I have people out there telling me my anarcho card needs to be pulled because I am not for a completely wide-open, porous border. But I will tell you, you can have a welfare state or you can have open borders. You cannot have both. You just can't. Not if you want a country. Not if you want a country. And there's a difference between a country and a nation state. We will not have a country if this continues, and I believe that is the goal. Amy McCann will talk about when you should, definitely should, use a weight belt in your training. Ben Falk will talk about developing a remote deer hunting property with permaculture. I'll have some thoughts on that one, too. Sean Mills will talk about thoughts on smart meters and concerns about them. That'll sort of kind of gel well with my anchor segment today. Eric Hammond will talk about, you know, he's our mechanics guy and all, but, you know, mechanics is more than just cars. It's putting stuff together. It's tools, right? He's going to talk about assembling the Vivor raised garden beds that I have been recommending, and I'll throw a little pitch hit on that because I've put a few of them together myself at this point. Jeff Lawton will talk about gardening over leach fields, and we are completely in agreement on this, but this is one of those questions I keep getting, so I'm going to say some more stuff when we get to that one as well. Because when I say we keep getting a question, if you think that means like, I don't want this question anymore, it's not what it means. It means that I recognize that this is an area that we need to talk about and that we need to keep educating about. And then my anchor segment today is not everything is a conspiracy, and you probably shouldn't listen to people that speak as though they know a thing before they have any facts at all. And somebody's opinion that they talked to on the phone who wasn't there because they have a degree does not make a fact. It makes an opinion. And it's fine to present things as opinions, but boy, do we have so many people, and I'm going to say even in mainstream right-wing media, that all of these conspiracies, and I've got a left-wing different type of conspiracy, so I would say even mainstream media, everything's a conspiracy, but in the alternative media space, Oh my God. I'm going to ask a question. I'll set it up now and then I'll ask it again when I do my segment. When we look at people like Alex Jones and people that fit in that lane in alternative media, can you think of a single major impactful event that has ever occurred? A terrorist attack, a shooting, a building burning down, a plane falling out of the air, anything of major impact and significance where they didn't take some angle on it being a conspiracy or the government's out to get you or Mossad did it or the CIA did it or something like that. Because I can't. I can't. I really cannot. And what are they doing it with now? The freaking eclipse. The eclipse. I'll hold myself back in. I'll talk about it when it's my turn. Before we hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini, I just want to remind you guys that you can help this show by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And I'm putting this in the front today because the item of the day is a deal of the day, and it's one of those deals of the day that often are gone the same day. DeWalt has its cordless, brushless, top-of-the-line jigsaw on sale today for $109. That's 54% off. It's the bare tool version, but the way I've seen jigsaws purchased by people, including myself, it's kind of the last thing in the cordless tool collection that you buy. You know, everybody starts out with a drill, an impact driver, and then you usually end up getting something like a skill saw, and then you usually end up getting something like a sawzall, and a few other pieces, parts. But then those are the stuff that you kind of like grab every day with everyday projects. Like, you're always going to have to cut a 2x4, and a skill saw does that perfectly. Or you're going to have to cut rip a long section of a piece of plywood, and while you can do that with a jigsaw, that long rip really works better with something like, you know, again, a skill saw, or you have that old beam, you're wrecking something out, a sawzall is perfect, or limbing a tree, a sawzall is perfect, right? You have all of that available. So we always are using drills and drivers, always, in everything that we do. And I even bought my cordless nail gun before I bought a jigsaw, because a cordless nail gun was so valuable to me working alone. Even when it was like, if I was going to go back in and reinforce it with bolts or something, if I was putting up, let's say, a 2x4 to act as a beam, being able to just take the nail gun and tack it where you wanted it on one side, throw a level on it, tack it on the other, and be able to do that by yourself without somebody helping you, that's what I need. So I got one of these exactly when this happened. It went on sale. I'm like, gee, I should get one. You know, I don't care that it's bare tool. I have plenty of batteries and chargers. And I bought one, and then I was like, dummy, you should have bought this a long time ago. I would say that and angle grinders are the two things we buy last that we probably should just go ahead and get when we can. But if you haven't yet, and you got something on sale from DeWalt, if you're a DeWalt person, at 54 points off, man, act now. And again, I put this up front today because I really think that there's a good chance that it won't be for sale by the end of the day. So if you listen as soon as the show comes out, maybe there's still time. And this is another impetus. Please get on the Telegram channel. It's not just so I can, you know, get more listens or whatever. I always put these things out as soon as I post them on Telegram, and things do disappear. Or what often happens with like DeWalt, they'll say, we want to sell X amount. So when half of that number sells, they raise the price. When another 10% of that number sells, they raise the price. And the price actually goes up throughout the day. So the earlier you know, the better deal you can get. So please go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on Get Social, and if nothing else, at least follow us on the Telegram channel. The reason I say that is you follow me on Twitter or whatever, you may or may not see it. But if you follow me on Telegram, on the channel, you'll see everything that I put out, as long as you have alerts on for Telegram. And I want to actually tell you one more thing on that right now. If you are a person that uses Twitter, X now, right? They have a feature called Lists, and I just put out a video with how to create lists. And what I think, if you're going to use Twitter, you should take all the people that you follow and just make one list called People I Follow or something like that. Because when you click on Following on Twitter, you don't see everything that everybody that you follow posts. But if you make a list, you will. And I will put a link in the show notes today, and I will include it in the Daily Mail today when that goes out. Anyway, 10-minute intro, really long. Sorry about that, but there's some stuff I wanted to cover today. Let's hear from Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul on what kind of nation allows itself to be invaded. Again, I say a really stupid one. Let's see what they say.
And now we're encouraging and offering up, oh, an empty house means you can, and you're an illegal, you know, an American citizen couldn't do this, of course. If you're illegal, you can go in there and just occupy it, and it's up to you to maybe get it back again. It's a really bad system. And unfortunately, that is what's going on. A lot of anger. People have died over this, and it's going to be worse. There was one clip on the internet where a Venezuelan was using it as a promotion. He says, you know what? If you go to America, if you find an empty house, they have a law that says you can just go in. And virtually that's happening. It's going in, and sometimes the owner gets into more trouble than the people who went into the house. So it's the whole breakdown that we have on justice system and the principle of laws. I think some of the massive problems we have with immigration now is the breakdown of the understanding of private property. Chris?
That's right, Dr. Paul. And it really amazes me that we're even talking about this. I mean, imagine a country that allows itself to be invaded. It's mind-boggling. Yet this is the country that we live in. And, you know, ironically, the vast majority of what our federal government does is unconstitutional. They shouldn't be doing it. It's against the law. But they ignore the law and they do it anyway because that's what they want to do. And nobody can hold them to account. But the one job that they do have to protect our borders, they're not even doing. You know, they're not protecting against an invasion. This is a basic. If you're going to have states get together and form a federal government, this was one of the selling points, you know, and they're just totally failing at it.
The people who promote this is policy. This is what they designed. This is what they want. This is their goal. And it isn't like it's an accident and a lack of enforcement. It's a deliberate policy, and they enforce the policy.
Yes, you know, the American colonies were formed under the idea of decentralized government, local government. There was this British government all the way across the ocean mistreating us. They're not here. They don't know what it's like to live here. You know, and they wanted out because government has to be local. You can't have this far-off government. Texas, look what just happened this week with Texas. There's this far-off government in D.C., that's supposed to protect the border, and they're not. So Texas is now going to take care of itself. Those people in D.C. that are whining and dining, they're not in Texas. They're not dealing with it. They'll watch it on TV at most. You know, so Texas has to deal with it themselves. And that's why this whole idea of global government is nonsense. You know, you can't have your governing authority over in Brussels or in Switzerland. But the tyrants want that because they're shielded. They're not near you. You have no access to them. You can't get to them. You can't replace them. That's why they are so hungry for it. And that's why you hear the words deep state. That's who those people are. You don't even know who they are. They're wielding all this power against you, and you can't do anything about it. You don't even know who they are. And that's why it's called the deep state.
I think the states right now are just pushed around overly so from the federal government, but what are you going to do if the federal government is corrupt? We have a problem there. It's a philosophic about a basic understanding of what real liberty means to all of us.
We see throughout history there's a common human error that keeps repeating itself. We're living through it right now. And that's the idea that if you destroy everything, then you'll be able to build back your utopia on the ashes. This goes back to the Soviets, to the French Revolution. This keeps repeating itself, where people, they don't like what they see, so they figure, let's just destroy everything, and then we'll start over and build back better. You know, society is not built that way. It's not built from the top down. It's not built at all. You know, it's not a bunch of dudes sitting around a table with a blueprint and they're going to implement their plans. Society flourishes first from moral principles. There has to be a common morality among the people first. You know, that has to be adopted, because if you don't have that, then the rest doesn't matter. Private property, sound money, voluntary interactions, none of that happens if you first don't have that moral principle. Western civilization had a common moral principle. It was called Christianity. Our country, same thing. That was the foundation, and then everything else, private property. I won't hurt you, you don't hurt me. This is mine, this is yours. Let's come together and exchange voluntarily. Let's have sound money. Well, the destroyers look at this, and they want to destroy it. So the first thing you do is you abandon all morality. All of it has to go. And then you start destroying. Private property is gone. Sound money is gone. Equality under the law is gone. You know, it all just gets peeled away, and they do destroy. The Soviets destroyed all the communists around the world and all those. They definitely destroyed, but guess what? It stays destroyed. They build absolutely nothing on top of the ashes. What has to happen is the people say, you know, these people are nuts. We need to start over with a moral foundation, and then you start building there.
Boy, there's a lot to unpack there. I'm going to only make a real quick mention of one of the last things said there, that when societies collapse, it's always right at about the time that we abandon all morality. I've had this discussion a little bit recently with people on X, and I have pointed that very thing out and said, if you would take the time to crack a history book beyond the surface level bullshit, and you'd look, you would see that this is a constant. And people always, when you say that, think of, well, you're talking about Rome. You know, Rome had other structural problems. Yes, but they also had a debauchery problem. Okay? But I'm not talking about Rome. I'm talking about, like, every advanced society that ever collapsed. Debauchery was always part of what went on right before they collapsed. I'm not talking about just Western culture. You know, when I read 1491 by Charles Mann about America before Columbus, I was blown away at how much like some of the stories from Rome, the stories out of like Mesoamerica were. All of the same shit, the incest, the concept of some classes being better than others, slavery, and debauchery. And how in many instances these societies collapsed long before, you know, European settlement. There are countless civilizations that rose and fell in the Americas that were great civilizations. And what it came down to? Debauchery. In many cases, they didn't really have a currency, but was poor resource utilization, which is kind of the same thing, really. Currency is one way we divide up and use resources. Another thing that I found to be very common in what went on here, and you tell me this isn't what's going on right now, that the government of the empire or group or what settlement or what have you would have a problem, and instead of marshaling resources to fix the problem, they would do something like a really big building project, right? But not a building project that fixed the problem. Sometimes the building project was making, for lack of a better term, the king's houses and the king's men's houses better, right? And splendor. There was exactly this happened with a huge settlement on the Mississippi River. They diverted one of the other streams that came into the Mississippi, so it ran through their village, completely changed its course. And there was plenty of time to fix all the shit that happened because of that and all the deforestation they did upstream. But instead, they made the town more opulent while it was falling apart. That was North America. This has happened in Mesoamerica, in Central America, and in South America to a lesser degree because there were less advanced civilizations there. But it happened. Happened in Asia. Happened in Japan. Happened in China. Happened in Korea. You get it yet? The human constant is this debauchery and incompetence of government at the end time of an empire and right prior to its collapse. It's also another thing they have in common, and they all built their civilizations on annual agriculture, which made them incredibly weak. So that's another constant there. Now, the other side of this I wanted to kind of mention here, I didn't know that Ron would lead off with what he did, talking about basically the squatter's rights thing, and I want to tell you that that term is being used a lot in the media. I know this is shocking inappropriately. The story that kicked it all off in New York actually has nothing to do with squatter's rights, not even a misappropriation of squatter's rights. What's going on in places like New York is they have very strong laws to protect tenants from landlords. So people move in, and yes, squat would be the term for what they're doing, but when they're confronted by law enforcement, they don't say, oh, I have squatter's rights. They say, oh, I live here. I have an agreement with them. I have a rental agreement with these people. I have a lease, and I pay them. And I've been paying my bill, and they're trying to throw me out now. They're standing under these eviction protection laws. And the homeowner's like, I don't know this person. And the cops are like, well, you know, you'll have to file with the court. It takes 90 days to 6 months to get that cleared up. And somebody's in your house with no proof of residency whatsoever. They will even at times, they make their own lease and they'll hand the cop a lease. They'll just write up their own lease and say, see, I have a lease with them. And they'll say, that's not my signature, the landowner. And they'll say, that's how he signed it. I don't know. Or they'll put somebody else's name on it and they'll say, well, it was their representative or whatever. And the cops will not evict that person. That's what's mostly going. Squatters' rights laws are usually something to this effect in most places. A place is abandoned, you move into it, and there'll be some bogey for how long you have to maintain it, and it has to be ignored by the on-paper owner. It's usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 years. I actually don't have a problem with that. If somebody abandons a place for 20 years and somebody else maintains it, I get why that law exists. But now this law is being bent, twisted, and integrated with these other protections to benefit the attacker versus the victim, which is so common in societies at the end of empire that are about to collapse. It's another pattern that you will find over and over again. Becoming complete welfare states. Like, oh, I don't know, every citizen of Rome got a daily ration of grain? Right? You want to talk about welfare of the time. That was the biggest welfare plan that ever existed, and it was impossible to maintain, and, oh, gee, it collapsed. But where I started before I had Dr. Paul on at the beginning during the intro, I said that the word for this is stupid. And it is stupid. But there's also another word for it. Intentional. Intentional. What do you call, because that would be stupid, what do you say about a nation that allows itself to be invaded? It wants to be invaded. And make no mistake about this. This is an invasion. And I have people in the anarcho community that are very upset with me. You're supposed to be an anarchist. You're not a real anarchist. Whatever. Shut up, Sal Mayweather. I'm serious. Like, yes, I called you out. I'm sorry. Shut your bullshit up. You know who it's easy to tell in the anarcho space? People with kids and grandkids versus people that have no children and no plans to ever have them. The people with no children, no future to concern themselves with, are really big on 100%. It's all about this principle with no pragmatism or reality on the ground. People with kids that know what we're leaving, that I know I will be in a box or a flaming box someday and a pile of ashes scattered to the wind, and I know that I'm going to leave behind people who I care about and that they're going to be here for a lot longer. You know, that my grandchildren have 70, 80 years of life ahead of them, and I care. And a person that's single and childless doesn't give a fuck because they can't even conceive of what they're leaving behind and to whom. And they'll talk like they do. They'll talk like they do because I'm concerned about the future. No, you're not. Or you would get out of your little bubble and you would look at what's happening. We have people coming into this country from everywhere through Mexico. They're refugees. No, they're not. A fucking Chinese person who comes to the United States via the Mexican border, walking across, is not a refugee. I'm sorry. It doesn't. Somebody doing that from Cameroon or Sudan is not a refugee. And when you have it happening in mass, and the purpose of doing it is, I'm going to get whatever I can get out of this, it is with harm, in mass with harm. When you have a large number of people crossing a national border causing harm, it's an invasion. And anybody that tells you it isn't is lying or stupid or just unwilling to look at reality. You take your pick. Moving on, let's go ahead and hear on something better, weight belts from Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia. And I realize that I don't really give much of an intro on myself, so I'll try to do that every time. But anyway, our job here is to help you become the hero of your own story, and I'm here to answer your health and fitness questions. So the question I got today is from Sharon from Utah, and she said, hey, when should I use, if ever, weight belts, and other gear. So I'm going to go into this, and my answer is not very popular, but I'm going to give you my reasoning for it, and then it's going to be like any great answer. It depends. But I'm using this as like a one is a none and two is one. So I'm doing this for my community and your community, Jack. So you're going to see CrossFit Garage. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see it. That's up. And then I'm going to go through some screens so that it helps me with talking points. But anyway, I've been doing this for about 17 years, and back in 2008, or 2007, when we started, we thought, hey, if we do all this strength and this movement, whatever, our joints are going to be crap and we're going to fall apart. And the real answer to that is no, your body wants to be used. So, the Survival Podcast community, the question for you guys is, I'm not really doing any of this stuff, and you said to get started, and it's something I should do. Should I be using implements and other gear to protect myself? And the answer is maybe. So in general, the answer is no, but it's maybe, because it depends on your exact circumstance. So Sharon, I don't really know, but I'm going to say if you have an injury, then that's probably the place where you're going to use it. But if you're just using belts and gear and stuff to get a better score, a higher number, then I would say don't do it and don't do the higher rep. So typically what's going to happen is you're going to have somebody wanting to do a deadlift and they're going to be building up in weight. And when they get to a certain weight, they're like, you know what, my back is rounding out or my core can't hold it, but my legs or my shoulders or whatever is still strong enough to do the lift. So here's the thing. If your body can't do it, then don't do it. So train yourself to get there rather than putting handicaps in place or stabilizers or whatever when you can't actually do it. So there's this thing. Let's go to the far extreme. There is a sport of powerlifting where they go to the bench press and they put on a bench press shirt and then they pull your arms together, right? So is it them lifting it or is it the shirt, right? So they're just adding some other device to help them out. So if you're putting on a weight belt, in order to make your back stable so that you can lift a heavier weight, I would argue go down in weight and lift to gain that control. So I would say no. If you're lifting to impress, I need a big number. The answer is no. If there's something wrong with your back, well, one, maybe you should go see somebody about that, chiropractor, doctor, I don't know, whatever. I don't know what's wrong with your back. But you should train out of it. So a long, long time ago, I was trying to chase down a 400-pound deadlift and messed my back up doing it. I'm a small guy. I shouldn't have been doing that. All the other guys were doing it. So I said, hey, hold my beer. Let's do it. And it wasn't very smart. Ever since then, I have had a bit of a back issue. Now, I have fixed that by one, I don't really lift deadlift like that very heavy. And two, I roll out my back and my glutes and my legs with a PVC pipe all the time. I've got a video on that. Maybe I'll somehow link it into this video or this talk so Jack can maybe show it. But it's a really basic rolling out, and it's basically kept my back fine for the last 15 years. I don't ever use gear. Now, could you? Again, it depends. If you want to post some number because someone bets you, then I guess maybe, but I think that's just stupid. If your back can't take it, don't do it. So there's other movements like the back squat. Again, it's usually a weight belt for my back. If your core can't hold the weight that you're trying to do, then you shouldn't do it. So there's a lot of other things you can go to. If you go to Amazon, you can find all sorts of gear. My favorite site is Rogue Fitness, and I've got a list of gear pulled up here. I'm just going to run through them so you can kind of understand the trap of gear you get into. So there are weight belts. There are lifting straps that you put around your hand and then you wrap around the bar. There are knee sleeves. There are hand sleeves that you basically think of a gymnast puts on these little hand like rawhide or whatever to keep them from tearing when they're on the bar. So my answer to you is if you're doing something, I know this isn't strength, this is gymnastics, but it's a gear question. So if you're doing something that's causing your hands to tear on the bar, I would go back and understand, what are you doing that's causing your hands to tear on the bar? And let's fix that first. Rather than putting a Band-Aid over it, let's put some cloth and keep doing it wrong. Let me figure out why. The next one are wrist wraps. People will put these around their hands so that it gives them stability. Now, I've been coaching for a very long time. I watch people when they put their arms there up, especially in a press position or an overhead squat, and their hands are bent back really far. They shouldn't be very far back. They should be such that the bar is going through kind of your forearm bone, whatever that's called, radius, oh no, maybe that's in your leg. Anyway, your hands should be up more. If your hand's completely flat back, then yes, of course your hand's going to hurt. And you should fix that rather than putting a strap around it, kind of band-aid it. So, no, I would say for most everybody, don't use any equipment. Understand your body, train it correctly to get you up there. So, Sharon, if you have an injury, go talk to someone first. If you have a bulging disc, that could be completely different. And there's really no amount of, I mean, you probably need codeine for that, right? So, Wraps, straps, and sleeves and all that other stuff are meant to kind of move you along the trajectory a little bit faster than your body maybe wants you to. So I do know guys and girls that wear knee sleeves, and it'll warm up their knees, and maybe that's a thing. I like to work out in pants and a hoodie so that I'm really warm, especially in the winter. So yeah, if you're wearing knee sleeves because it feels like, hey, my knees are getting warmed up, then great, and I don't want to wear pants, right? So knee sleeves would work in that case. If you're wearing knee sleeves because it hurts when I go down, then I would say let's understand what the pain is. Okay, so would I wear gear? No. If I'm going for strength, shouldn't I be lifting heavy? No. So if you look up standard hypertrophy models, it's usually like 3 sets of 10, and it's not really going to be crazy heavy in the sense of a 1 rep max. It's going to be stuff that you can do, but you want to build your body up and around that. All right, hopefully that answers your question. If you got other questions, you can email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. I'll put them on Jack and my podcast and whatever so you can hear it. And I am happy to help you guys with whatever you got right now. The questions are very minimal, so I can answer them, and I can work with you directly. I am in Woodstock, so actually coming to see me is really tough, but I'm happy to help. All right, guys, you guys take care and have a great day.
I only slightly disagree. I think when you start lifting significantly heavy weights, especially in standing positions like deadlifts and squats, no matter how well-conditioned you are, that it makes a lot of sense to wear a back belt. I really do, because the consequences of injury are so significant. I am on board with what Andy is saying about don't do it just to lift more weight. And I think most of the gear is unnecessary. But again, lower back just even pulls and strains. My issue there is not even that maybe they're life-altering, but if you're training, an injury like that can set you back for days, weeks, or even months on your training. So I think it's as much to prevent serious injury as it would be to ensure that we do not derail our progress while we're training. That's just my thoughts. And, you know, Andy's way more into this than me, and he's probably also coming at it from a slightly different perspective. I'm coming at it from, hey, it's a belt, it protects your back, it works, you should probably use it. He's coming off of it from someone that's deeply involved with CrossFit. And those are kind of different perspectives. And that's okay. It's okay that we have different perspectives. We should. And that way you can pick the perspective that works best for you, and you can pick the perspective that works best for your situation in the context of your situation. I see no need for somebody, for instance, curling 15-pound dumbbells to wear a weight bench. I mean, a weight belt. I just don't. It doesn't make any sense to me. Or wrist wraps or anything like that. You know, wrist wraps, I would say, like, I work out with a heavy bag all the time. I don't wear wrist wraps. When you're getting started, as you begin to increase your punching power, and you have not yet kind of learned your lesson, so to say, with how you strike a bag, you might want to. Because you talk about something, you know, that can throw back your training for a while. That's one of them too. Anyway, with that, let's talk about building up deer habitat and feed around a remote hunting camp using permaculture principles.
Hey, Jack and all. Ben Falk with the Expert Council and Whole Systems Design. A question about a camp property where it's wooded. It's in New York State. Doesn't sound like there's much work able to be done there, at least not in an ongoing way. I don't have a sense of soils there, which is pretty key. But I can tell you that apples and pears are a good choice, depending where in New York State. A lot of eastern New York and by the lake, Big Lake, is going to be harder to grow apples in a decent way, because of the commercial orchards that are already in those areas. When you're near those, you tend to get a lot of pests because the monocultures, larger scale production systems breed a lot of pests. And so the Hudson Valley, for instance, is pretty hard to grow a decent apple, whereas that's the opposite in most of like woodsy New England, hilly New England where I am. Blueberries are pretty high maintenance until you get them really established. Like a lot of mulch, pretty acidic. Is this well drained? Is it acidic? Is it alkaline? Central New York has all of the above. If it's really acidic, chestnuts are great. Great for deer food plot as well. Very, very good. It's hard to beat like aronia and black currant for just an adaptable berry. The latter of which is good fresh eating and for all sorts of ferments and stuff. The aronia is best in like juices, ferments, tonics, not so much raw. But those are just beastly plants. They just go, especially aronia. Give them a little love for the first year or two. Mulch, you know, weed suppression, some fertility, and you're good to go. And I say black currant, not red and white. They're a lot more work to get going. Those are about as easy as it gets. I'm just thinking low maintenance because it doesn't sound like you're there full time. There's obviously a lot more if you're willing to put the time in for soil love and care to get everything going. But you know, it's a pretty short list if you're not there to do that. There's other nut trees, of course, like Eastern Black Walnut, great, hickory, probably hardy to that area as well, as long as it's not into the Adirondacks. So, yeah, those are some ideas. Those are some of the easier, low-maintenance plants that we've worked with that are edible, but it's certainly not all of them. There's some other options too, but those are, I think, the lowest hanging fruit. Good luck.
So this did not come in with a great deal of information about the site, as you can tell from Ben's answer. I don't know, like a lot of times people have these camps and they have a fairly small piece of land, especially New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, that whole northeastern area. It's very common that people have a small piece of land adjacent to, you know, a state forest or state game lands or something like that. So it's limited what they can really do like this. But if it's a significantly sized piece of land, let's say you have, you know, even 10 acres, it might really be worth creating like a half acre glade and putting in a food plot. And that's something really easy once you get it established to remote manage by being there just a few times a year. A four-wheeler, you don't need a tractor or anything. A four-wheeler with a few little things can do pretty much everything you need to do to maintain a food plot of that size. But putting in some water resources would be another thing. And if I had 10 acres, I would put stuff like that as close to the center as possible, especially if you're adjacent to a place where a lot of the public hunts, which is most likely the case in the area that we're talking about. That would be one thing. On all the things that Ben mentioned, probably the one that has the rapidest rate of return will be chestnut, and Chinese chestnut will do fantastic in that climate. It grows very bushy, and it will have a heavy drop, and of course, it's once you get above browse line with the tree, the nuts are well protected by a burr until they're ready to drop. So that would be, and then another one I would add, and I'm not sure how far north in New York this is and how well this would work, but persimmon. Persimmon trees get really, really tall, and they drop a lot of mast eventually, and I have seen deer literally turned around because they heard one drop from a tree. I remember many years ago, I was hunting at a farm I had permission to hunt on in Pennsylvania, bow hunting. There was a small, like, four-corn buck. He was just out of arrow range. I'm not a trophy hunter. This dude, he would have got an arrow right through the lungs if he would have got just a little bit closer. And he was eating persimmons. And, you know, he ate, like, all the persimmons. And he turned to his right, and he headed, like, out across the soybean field. He was heading to the other wood line or doing whatever he was doing. And he got 25, 30 feet away, and the wind blew. And this persimmon tree swayed, and one persimmon dropped and hit the ground, and that deer turned around like his best friend was calling him. Ran back over, ate that persimmon. I'm like, come on, man, come on. Nope, he just trotted back across the field and went on about his little deer way and lived to be a deer another day. So persimmon would be another one I would consider. Don't forget things like water resources. And I'll tell you the number one thing in high-pressure areas that really makes great deer hunting, and it's not food. It's not food, it's not salt licks, it's not feeders that are illegal up there, it's cover. The thickest, nastiest cover, and if you control the land, a way that you can get into there very, very quietly. I grew up hunting in Pennsylvania, as many of you guys know, and that was our entire family's modus operandi. We found the thickest, nastiest, hardest places to get into, and we developed our own approach to get into those, and we simply let other hunters move those deer to us, because when deer are pressured, that's where they go. So you look at wind currents for the season and all, and cover when it comes to just being able to harvest and having deer pushed around. Because here's the thing about the area you're in that I can tell you. At least every other year, in the fall when you have hunting season, you have a massive mass drop of acorns. And in that area, a shitload of them will be white acorns, which are preferred, plus beech nut and hickory nut and things like that. And you can only do so much to attract deer with feed in that environment, because there's food everywhere. Even here in Texas, where it's completely legal to set up a deer feeder, and people think, oh, it's like cheating. Well, you don't understand the situation at all, so don't talk about it. The feeders are dramatically ineffective in years with heavy mass drop from the oaks. There's times when you walk through like a tree line and you feel like you're going to like fall on your ass. Remember the movie with Kevin, right? Home Alone, the one in New York where he throws the beads on the ground and the bad guys fall on the ground from the necklace beads? It's like that. And when deer have that much available to them, and you're either pre-rut, prime rut, or just coming out of the rut, so I'm chasing girls, and the girls are getting chased, and there's food everywhere, just because you have some apple trees or something doesn't mean I'm coming to your spot. But if you give me a place to hide when other people are trying to kill me, yeah, that works all the time. Just a thought from an old deer hunter. And with that, let's talk about smart meters with Sean Mills.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and I've got an expert panel question today on smart meters. So the question is, what is Sean's thoughts on smart meters on a home? Is this something that could be of any concern as we seek to protect our families? Details. Smart meters are something that I have become aware of in the last few years in the process of learning about alternative medicine and general health. I'm not sure what to think about smart meter radiation, much similar to the concerns around millimeter wave 5G. There seems to be a split in the Freedom community on this topic. Is it worth trying to request your electrical company switch out your smart meter for a traditional analog meter? The smart meter that is on my home seems to be a open-way Centron by Itron that uses some RF LAN technology. Thank you, Ben in Pittsburgh. Hey, Ben, this is a good question, and it's not one that I deal with a ton because I primarily focus on off-grid installations. But since the inverter technology has changed recently to allow cost-effective behind-the-meter grid interactive systems where you have a grid input, generator input, solar input, and battery input all in the same device, and in the event that the grid goes down, you can still run your loads off of those other methods, I have had to learn a little bit about this, and I do have some customers who are EMF sensitive. Now, I know that that's kind of woo-woo in a sense. There's a lot of people who don't believe that that's a thing. It's not my job to argue with someone about how they feel. I can't indicate, you know, that how they feel is based on one reason or another. So if they tell me that electromagnetic frequencies make them feel bad, my job is to believe them and to do what I can to try to mitigate any issues there. So on to the smart meters. The smart meters do emit some EMF, and they also can create what's called dirty electricity in your system. Now, the reality is that pretty much everything you plug into your system creates dirty electricity, and your neighbor's dirty electricity can also make the electricity coming into your house dirty. And what dirty means is that you're just getting frequencies that are not part of, you know, what is supposed to be there and what is required to run your appliances. So if I have, you know, certain frequencies of electrical components that are needed for my microwave to work, there's probably a bunch of other ones in the house, and some of those aren't actually used by the house, and they just kind of resonate in the copper wiring. And that's the thing that can cause some sensitivity issues for people. So as a general rule, I would say if you can not have a smart meter, don't have a smart meter. There's nothing that you actually gain, you, the consumer, by your company putting in a smart meter. All that that does is it allows them to understand your electrical usage remotely, so they don't have to send out someone to read your meter. And it also allows them to understand things like what your peak usage is over a certain period of time or at a certain period of time.
And that is useful information for the grid operator because they can plan for, you know, peak demand as it relates to things like really hot times of years where it's abnormally hot and everyone's got their air conditioner running. Now, one of the things I don't really like about the powers that be, quote unquote, having more information about how I use their services that I pay for is that I did not agree to provide that information when I agreed to use their service. I agreed that I would pay X amount per kilowatt hour for the service that they provide me, and not that I would provide them all kinds of information about how my house uses electricity, when it uses electricity, how much it uses at a given point in time versus over the billing period. So I feel like that that extra data is being utilized at, you know, to profit for the company that I'm working with, and I didn't agree to provide that data. So that's number one. And then number two, from a nefarious standpoint, they could always come to you and say, hey, you know what? You use more power than the other folks in your neighborhood. So we are going to either A, throttle your power, B, only allow you to use power when your neighbors don't need it, or C, charge you a different rate. And this kind of goes into the whole Internet of Things, right? Where the more information big corporations have on you, number one, the more profitable that they can be, and which I don't have a problem with. But number two, it also provides a control mechanism. So if you think that in the middle of the summer when there's rolling brownouts in a neighborhood that has smart meters that they can't control which houses brown and which houses don't, then you're not paying attention. So not to get all conspiracy theory, but like I said, in general, there's nothing that you gain from having a smart meter, and there's a lot of things that could potentially go wrong with that, as well as the fact that you're just providing, you know, basically access to personal data that you didn't necessarily agree to provide. So those are my thoughts on the smart meter. If you guys have any other questions, get them in the Jack, and I will get them answered.
I have to say that's a very fair, well-rounded, and accurate explanation by Sean, so I got nothing to add to that. Let's go on to assembling these metal Vivor garden beds that I've been recommending and a ton of you guys have bought. Some thoughts here from Eric Hammond.
Greetings, Eric Hammond here with another expert counsel segment on these Vivor raised garden beds, these 4x8x2 beds. These things are awesome. I just got mine together and filled up, and I wanted to go through some tips for assembly on these things. This is the fourth bed I've put together that's this style. I think that you should plan on about 2 hours for assembly. That doesn't include filling it up. I've got them down to about an hour and 15 minutes now, but that's for doing it by yourself. It is a little bit of work. I'm going to go through the tools, the layout, the assembly, and some upgrades. So for tools, you're going to need a number 3 Phillips. That's not your typical Phillips. That's a bigger Phillips than we're used to using. There's 140 screws to put this together. There are Phillips on one end and a wing nut on the other end. I would get a large or long Phillips, probably like 1.5 or 2 inches long. Put that in a drill or an impact driver or a screwdriver if you want to go that route. You're going to want a pair of pliers. A wing nut driver would be an awesome addition for putting this together, and I'll tell you why. I went through and put this together with a Phillips on a drill and then just used like a pair of pliers on the backside and tightened all the screws, but you end up stripping some of the screw heads out. And these screws are a zinc plated screw. They're a pretty cheap screw. Once you strip that out, they end up rusting pretty quickly. So the way to avoid that would be to hold the Phillips side with a regular screwdriver and then drive the wing nut and tighten the wing nut. And a wing nut driver can help you do that. It looks just like a regular socket with a slot cut in it to accommodate for the wings. That would prevent them from stripping out, and it would look good for years to come. And these are some good looking beds, so if you're into aesthetics, that might be something to think about. And then just a small shovel to help flatten out the earth underneath it. for the layout of this thing, put it close to where you want it. It's going to be a challenge to move with one person. If you got two and the whole thing's assembled, you might move it a little bit, but you're not going to want to move it real far. Pick a flattish area that's sort of level. You know, if it's sloped, you know, a couple inches front to back or side to side, that is not a deal breaker, but it does need to be flat on the bottom where it meets the ground so the soil won't come out. When you look at the panels, there's two different sizes, so four of them are going to be shorter than the rest. Those are going to be your 4 foot end pieces, so set those to the side. There's plastic that covers all the outsides of these panels, and it's a chore to get off. So set those panels in the sun and getting warming up so that by the time you're done reading the instructions, you can peel that plastic off a lot easier since it's warm. Get some trays to put all your screws in. There's a lot of them, and they don't give you very many extras. I had like one extra, so if you're in the grass and you drop these, it could be a problem towards the end. When you go to assemble this thing, put two screws in each panel. Don't tighten anything. Don't tighten anything. I do the 4 foot ends first, then I put the corners onto those 4 foot ends, then you can assemble your sides and then build the whole thing. Do your braces last. Don't even worry about doing the braces until you have the whole box built. Once you put the braces in, start all the screws before tightening anything. You want them all loose, and then you're going to go through and tighten all your screws. Don't touch the wing nut with your fingers if you're going to put a drill on the Phillips side, or you're going to end up tearing yourself up. Resist that urge. Use a pair of pliers. Put something up against the wing nut that is not your fingers. It's going to hurt bad. When you go to tighten these, the tops of where the panels meet, if the ground is uneven, it can have two sharp corners. So make sure to push those flush before you tighten the screws, and that's really going to help eliminate any sharpness. When you put the corner pieces on, pull the corner pieces up to tighten them, and that's going to make room for the edge guard that goes all around the top to help cover up that sharp edge. And then think about gluing that edge guard on if you have small kids around. I have four of these beds, and I don't know where any of the edge guard is anymore. They've taken it, and they've ran off. So you might want to think about gluing that stuff in. As far as upgrades to your raised metal bed, think about stubbing in some irrigation pipes before you fill this up. That'll be hard to do later. And then think about adding additional bracing. It's going to cost you less than $5. I used half-inch EMT electrical conduit. You can smash one end flat. You can bend that over on a corner and drill a hole in it, and then measure out 36.5 inches, flatten it, and bend another edge on it. And you can use that as a stiff brace. So what this does for you is I moved the original braces from the top down to about the middle, and then I put these EMT conduit pieces three holes down, and that allows me to fill the whole bed up and cover up all the braces with soil. The way they have you assemble this originally, you end up with braces that are actually above the soil surface. It's kind of a pain to work around and not aesthetically pleasing. It's an easy upgrade to make, and it's totally worth the money. I hope that helps you assemble your raised beds. They are a great, awesome value. Shoot any mechanical questions my way and I'll get them answered. And if you want to see the additional bracing, I have a short video on my YouTube channel, Eric Hammond, The Joy of Homesteading, and that video is just titled $5 Upgrade for Your Raised Metal Garden Beds. Thanks.
So a few things. Number one, the edge guard, I just threw it away. I see no point to it. I do not believe that rubbery piece of plastic is going to last more than a season in the sun in Texas, and probably not in most places. We're going to put our garden beds where they're heavily sunned on. I don't think it's necessary. The top of the steel is rolled, and I'm not worried about it. And with what I've done to reconfigure mine, I don't have enough of it anyway because I've vastly increased the length. The overall length by reconfiguration. So, I basically have turned four by eight by two into one, 2x8x2 and one, 2x12x2. because of where my wife wanted to put them. I think the advice on making sure that you kind of level and push down on where the seams are when you do the final tighten is great advice, because that is the one place where you could catch an edge. You're not going to catch an edge anywhere else. Again, the tops of the panels are rolled. The plastic coating, yes, is a pain in the ass, and I did not know about it until after the fact. And it is a pain in the ass, and you should take it off before you put it together. It really is, and I kind of wish it wasn't there. I kind of wish it wasn't there. On the tightening, I actually disagree to a large degree here, and it is a matter of the using tools in the appropriate manner. And this is what I mean. Like, you only need to tighten these things so much. So instead of using an impact driver with a screw, a screwdriver bit, I use a drill. And you can set your torque to a point where you're going to get a good, tight, snug fit, but you don't have to Rambo the shit out of this. And this is why. Galvanized or not, zinc or not, you're going to fill this with dirt, and in time there will be rust, and you're not going to have screws backing out. This thing doesn't move. It sits still. It's got dirt piled up against it, moist dirt piled up against it. I would challenge somebody to take one of these things out, to unscrew it in a couple seasons. That's when you're going to have stripping, and it's so much the case that I did kind of what he did. I used a pair of, well, the what do you call them? Knipex, the ones that are like the pipe pliers, because I use them for everything now, to hold the wing nut. And I just used a DeWalt cordless, like my low-end drill. I think I had the torque set somewhere around 4, 4.5 on it. So I just kept increasing it until I was like, yeah, that's really good. And then that way, the drill itself will not go beyond that. And I used the number 2 Phillips. He's right. Number 3 is the right answer. But I keep number 2 Phillips screwdriver bits, like, by the gross. So I used what I had. And I had no stripping problems at all because I had the torque set low enough to get a good snug fit, but yet not trying to Rambo it with an impact driver or something. That's just my thoughts on that one. But, I mean, both, again, different perspectives, different context. You choose what works for you. I do like the idea of a wing nut holder, and I think I know something that would work beyond one dedicated. There are, and I've never tried one of these, there are, like, universal sockets that have little pins in them. That should work for that, too. That should work for that, too. Maybe I should check into those and what have you. The other thing is, so I've done really well with Vavor out of the gate, all in about $30,000 worth of sales. So thank you guys for that, because that will help me long term. But there's a bigger thing to that. When I first got this deal with Vavor, they were like, yeah, we'll take you. Now they're like, what can we do for you? So I have two other products coming for review. Understanding that I'm probably not going to be handed a $2,000 product or something like that. If you're perusing Vavor, Vavor.com, V-E-V-O-R.com, and you should totally go through my links. One, I get credit, but two, you can use my discount code, and you can get 5% off everything there, and you can find it all at tspaz.com. But if you see something you'd like to see me review, I would love to hear about it. TSPC in the subject line, send me a link to the product. Don't just tell me what it's called. Send me a link, because there's a lot of things in the Vavor catalog. There's like 5 that are similar to each other, and I could find the wrong one. And my rep told me today, whether it's available for, you know, like all the influencers or not, as long as they have it in stock and everything else lines up, that anything that I want to review, just tell her what it is and she will square it away so that I can get a sample of it for you guys. So help me help you in that regard. With that, let's go ahead and move on to our next one, Gardening Over Leach Fields with Jeff Lawton.
Hi, Jeff Lawton here, coming to you from Jordan, where I'm working at the moment. And I have a question coming in here about a septic tank, right? Somebody's had their entire septic tank replaced, and the new leach field runs over the corner of what was our garden, and that was the most ideal location. Otherwise, they've got to move a long way away, so 75 to 100 feet away from water, and they're in zone 6A in northwest Ohio. The reason they put the leach field there is because for It was just ideal site in the sun, away from the trees and far enough from the house. But it's a good garden site, and it's ideal for the sun, for the garden too. And it's a good site close to water. And they're worried about it. The recommendation is to be 20 feet away with the garden. Well, I've gardened right on top of leach fields, because I know if it's your leach field, you know what's going into the wastewater. So you know what food you're eating, you know what waste products that you're throwing down the grey water system. If you're using biological soaps and biological cleaning materials, there's nothing bad going down the septic. Your manure is fine. I mean, your family has all the pathogens you're going to get anyway, but they're going through a septic tank before they get down to, you know, the leach field. So I wouldn't worry about it at all. And you've only got the corner clip in the garden. I've actually designed leach fields so that they're under the footpaths of the gardens on many occasions. Never had a problem at all. In fact, I think it's a great asset, actually. So I think the over-regulation is being just too cautious, especially when we live an organic life where we're buying mostly biodegradable biological products. So I wouldn't worry about it in the slightest.
Okay, I've been doing this almost 16 years, and it has nothing to do with the question itself. This is the first time I ever had to do this. I was listening to that multitasking so I could comment on it. And it sounded like my geese were throwing a fit in my living room. The sound was coming from the wrong... I had to rewind and realize those were geese in the background of Jeff's area, not my geese. Because my geese, the girl goose, has eggs, and the two boy geese are out like trouncing anybody or anything that gets near the girl goose right now. So I was like, did they get in the house? Because the kids are out and in and the doors are open. That was pretty trippy. I get this question all the time. A lot of times I just answer it in an email. I literally have a signature to answer this because I probably get this at least once a week, and I try to talk about it once a quarter at least on the air to make sure that we don't like stop answering a question that so many people have. Here's my basic answer to this. Don't grow perennials on your leach field. Grow anything else you want. Now think about weight, because you can get compaction issues and stuff like that. If you're putting structures there, you can't service it. Like, that's a bad idea. A garden? Absolutely. And I want to say something else about this. Like, when I hear people that are reasonable about this and say you can ignore it, but they also still say things like, you know, don't grow things that touch the ground, I don't get it. I have owned four properties. I lived in four and owned three properties with septic systems and leach fields. I've never seen a leach field where the water comes up out of the ground. I mean, I don't know. Maybe some of them do, but I've in different climates. I've lived in Texas. I've lived in Arkansas. I've lived in Pennsylvania. Different soil types, different terrain, different, you know, elevations. I have never seen, like, the leach field is sopping wet, like there's water on the surface. The other side of this is, you know, there's two types of septics, two main types of septics. And one is, you know, the ones for places with a lot of compaction, you can't get percolation and all, where you have misters that, like, spray. And I wouldn't spray it on lettuce, okay? I get that, right? But most people have a two-tank system. They have a solid, a liquid, and then diffuse into the leach field. So the way that works is you flush the poop and the pee, and it goes into the solids tank, and that breaks down with bacterial action, and eventually the water, the liquid, goes into the second tank, and the second tank overflows into the leach field. It's not like it's raw sewage. I mean, I'm not going to open up my water tank, my second tank, and drink it, and it doesn't smell great, but it doesn't smell like sewage either. So I think this is a concern that we only have because we've been told to be concerned about everything, and we just need to relax. And the one thing I'll say is perennials and deep root systems, and leach fields are not compatible with each other. Other than that, grow what you want, right? Grow what you want. All right, moving on. Let's go ahead and deal with what I want to talk about today. I'm going to try to be short with it. But I really am at a point where I am, and I've always felt this way, but I'm getting there more and more now because there's so much amping. Everything's so bad. Why do we have to amplify things that aren't true? Right? So everything's a conspiracy theory now. So, of course, the boat hit the bridge this week, and I did an episode talking about it because I was like, yeah, we have a real risk to our infrastructure. And I said, I guarantee you the Alex Joneses of the world will be saying it's some kind of conspiracy before the day ends, and hell, son of a gun, if they're not. And even Dan Bongino, who is not completely all in on conspiracy theory, is at least using the concept as clickbait to get eyeballs on him. Right? And I would say he's a really more of a mainstream media guy than Jones is, certainly. Right? Sometimes shit just happens because people are incompetent or stupid or equipment fails. Okay? Sometimes shit just happens. Now, I've said, and I will continue to say, right now, I can't tell you for certain that there's nothing like out of the ordinary with what happened. But it doesn't look like there is. And there is not a shred of evidence. You saying the boat took a turn and did it on purpose, then why the fuck did they go through all the bullshit? Right? They shut their own engines down. If you're going to just do it anyway, just sail into the damn thing. Or point it at it before you kill your engines and then blame the engines. They were trying to correct it. Jesse Waters on Fox, that's pretty mainstream. You could tell he wanted to do this too. Night that it happened, he brings a captain on, old crusty captain. Dude has piloted these types of container ships for 30 years. And Jesse's like, oh, what do you think really happened? And the guy's like, we call it in the space losing the plant. It happens to all of us at times. And usually it doesn't happen near a bridge. Usually it happens like out at sea or something. You have time to rectify. He's like, there's not a captain who's piloted ships like this that has not had this happen. And what it looks like is probably what it is. And then he went on to commend the captain who was piloting this container ship and saying his actions of the instant mayday and doing all he can probably saved a lot of lives. And they were trying to correct the problem. And when you say something took a rapid... Container ships don't take rapid turns. You're watching this at 8 or 12x speed, depending on which one you're watching. There is no rapid turn. If you watch the footage at regular speed, it is so slow it makes you think, again, of science fiction shit where something's going in a black hole. But when you have that much, well, that shouldn't bring down a bridge. Do you even have a clue what the kinetic impact is of a ship that size moving at about, you know, probably about 6 knots, 6-7 knots? And people say, well, they got this engineer, and he, I don't give a shit what an engineer said sitting on his ass in Iowa or Ohio or California. I care what a captain that actually runs these ships has to say. Right, and I'm not, again, I'm not saying it wasn't. I'm just saying it probably isn't. And there's so many people hyping it, talking like they know. You don't know. Same thing I said Tuesday. You don't know anything, so stop talking like you do. What else is going on right now? There's an eclipse, and Alex Jones is out with this bullshit again. This motherfucker never learns. Right? Oh, they're using it as a test case for martial law. If they're going to do martial law, they're just going to do martial law. They don't need a test case for it. May I remind you of what caused me to walk away from Oath Keepers? And, oh, thank God I did when I did. Operation Jade Helm. They're going to take over Texas. It was stupid. It was so ever-loving. And then when nothing happened, it's just a test case. You wait and see. How many years ago is that? Look it up. If you don't know, I'm not going to tell you today. It's the same shit, it's the same script, over and over and over again. And you know I don't give the establishment a pass. I don't say that they're not up to shit all the time, but they are more likely to take advantage of a thing than to cause a thing. Do you know how much hyper-competence you're giving your own government to say they did this on purpose and pulled it off? And in what way would it benefit them? You don't understand, Jack. You know who did it? China did it because they were angry about fill in the blank. Well, maybe, but do you have any evidence of that? Well, we know that they have the ability to cyber attack things and do things like this. Okay, that's not evidence. And you're also making a claim that you haven't proven. Maybe, I don't know. But until you know, how about you shut up? How about you shut up? Or at least when you voice your opinion, you voice it as an opinion. There's so much hype and lather. Now what are they all upset about? Oh, the eclipse. So the eclipse thing is broken into two groups. There is an, I am shocked at the number of these people. There is a massive number of the religious right that think Jesus is coming. Because it might be cloudy when we have an eclipse, and it's a really dramatic eclipse. Like we've had millions of throughout the history of the planet. I've heard so much about this. There are people that are refusing to travel during this eclipse because they think it's the apocalypse and Jesus is coming in the sky. Look, you believe whatever you want with religion. I don't attack anybody's religion directly. I will just say this, that every single group of people who ever believed they had figured out the time of the sun's return have been disappointed. I don't expect that to change this time either. And by the way, if Jesus is coming to get you, good for good or bad, to take you into the sky or to condemn you to the pit or whatever you think is going to happen, whether you're at home or on your way to Disneyland will not matter, will it? Will it? Right? So I don't get that. But then there's the Alex Joneses of the world. They're using it to test case martial law. Why are they declaring emergencies? Well, what's going on in Texas? We have these little towns that have like 100,000 or 200,000 people. And so they're big enough to have like a traffic department and shit. And the traffic departments and all are looking at the surrounding communities, a number of people that say they're going to travel to see the eclipse. And they're like, holy shit, we're going to have 400,000 people in our town of 100,000 for a couple days. We can't deal with this. So they're setting up things to have like traffic directed and things like that, because if they don't do it, it's going to be a nightmare. Now, if they didn't do it and it was a nightmare, everybody would talk about how screwed up and incompetent they are. But all of a sudden, Kaufman, Texas, the city council of Kaufman, Texas is in on it. Right? They're helping Biden. The city council of Kaufman, Texas is helping the Brandon administration rehearse martial law. That's what freaking Alex Jones is saying. You know why? You got to listen to the way this asshole presents things. And I'm going to tell you something about Alex Jones in case you think I'm just a hater. Jones is the person that I most want to like that I'm incapable of liking. There is so much he gets right. There is so much he makes people aware of. Because when it's real, he'll talk about that too. But he is so full of his own bullshit. And you can go all the way back to December 31st, 1999, and listen to the way this asshole covered Y2K. As though things were actually exploding and nuclear shit was going off around the world when, you know, it becomes New Year's in Australia first type of thing. It was ridiculously stupid, and then he just went on like he never did it, and it's never changed ever since. So, according to Alex, the city of Kaufman, Texas, is working with the Biden administration to enable them to practice implementing martial law. So that way, when absolutely fuck all nothing happens, and it won't, and then people say, well, what up? But that was just, they're just floating it. They're just testing it. You wait and see come the election. Right? And then if Brandon wins, they'll say, well, there was no need to do it. And if Trump wins and nothing happens, they'll say, well, they test ballooned it and it didn't work, or some other nonsense. Folks, I know a lot of you listen to other media other than me, and I'm very glad that you do. You should never get all your information from one source. But this is what I'm going to tell you flat out. When you're listening to a source that speaks as though they have facts when they do not, that source is not trustworthy. Okay? And I always say, check everything, including what I tell you. But you can rest assured that I'm trustworthy. I might be wrong, but I'm not lying and I'm not bullshitting. People like this are always lying and they're always bullshitting because they build their empire on it. I will tell you flat out right now, if every day I got on the air and like, their cities are going to burn, guys, you better get ready. I'm telling you, like when I'm doing my shows, I'm like, get out, get out, get out. If I did that every day, if that was all I did, if all I did was talk about how bad things are and all the things that they're doing to come and get us, if I kept talking about the United Nations and how they actually have a plan, they got a plan, man, they're going to come in here and they're going to get us. If I did that every day, and I said, you better go to my Patriot Supply and get your macaroni and buckets, because if you don't, you're going to starve when you're on the blue line waiting to get in a train to go get killed. They have coffins in Atlanta. They're ready to put you in the coffin. Hey, what happened with that? Remember those? That's like 10 years ago, Alex. Where's the caskets? Where's all the camps they were going to throw us into? Oh, they were just getting ready. They're going to get... If I got on the air and I did that every day, I would be about 10 to 50 times larger than I am right now. You know what I would also be? Trapped like a rat. I would be trapped like a rat. I'd be like, Alex, hey, join my MLM bullshit. Because I would need money to prop up my empire that's built on lies, which must be maintained with lies and clickbait and bullshit. And you might just think, oh, he's jealous. That's why he's talking shit about Alex Jones. No. No, if you listen to this for any length of time, you know that's bullshit. You know that the reason that I throttle myself with things like that, even the stuff that I believe in, is two reasons. One, it allows me to be honest and have integrity and have freedom from shit like that. I don't have to keep digging more up. And two, I don't care what the problem is. The answer is the solution. And I vastly prefer to discuss the solution than the problem. If you want eyeballs, talk about the problems. If you want action, if you want to make a difference, if you want to make an impact, talk about, focus on the solutions. Turn away from these people. They do not have your best interest at heart. They have their own best interest at heart. What new sponsor can I sign up? How much money can I make? I made a commitment to myself when I started this podcast. I made a commitment to myself that I would build it up to where it provided the lifestyle that I wanted, and that that would be enough. And if it got bigger, great. And if it didn't, so what? That I would never compromise my integrity. I spent until my late 30s, one way or another, in the good old regular version of corporate America. By the time I was 26, I was incredibly successful in that space. I did another 12 years of it before I walked away into this. And so many times in those years, coming up and after I'd quote-unquote made it, I had to eat dinners with people I didn't want to shake hands with. I had to say things I didn't believe. I had to defend decisions of companies that I represented that I did not want to defend. I had to do so many things that I didn't want to do. When I started TSP and I saw my way out of that, I said, not only will I leave it, I will never create it for myself again. And I say this to you today as someone on the verge of 3,500 podcasts, someone that's made a living for, I've been doing this, I'll be 16 years this summer. And at that point, I'll have made a full-time living with it for 14 and a half years. Because I know there's some of you out there thinking about getting into this game. Please get into this game. You will not harm me or anybody else that's good by joining us. But when you do, think about what you're doing. Do you want rapid success? Or do you want to end up imprisoned by your own empire? Do you want rapid success? Or do you want lasting success? Because we need more people in this space. We need them here for news stuff. We need them here for agriculture and permaculture stuff. We need them here for fitness, like Andy's doing with his podcast, right? We need people to continuously build this vault, you know, this vault of information and discussion beyond the bullshit. And just remember, just because somebody's alternative media doesn't mean they're any better than mainstream media. I don't quote the Bible a lot, but judge the tree on its fruit. Judge the tree on its fruit. And so many people are judging these trees based on how many leaves they have, how many branches they have, how tall they are. But do they have any fruit? Do they have any nut mass? Do they drop anything? What do I mean by judge the fruit? Look around the communities of these people, the ones that are doing it right, in my opinion anyway. You will see others building things inspired by them. You will see businesses that are born in those communities. You will see other creators who were born out of those communities. You will see communities that were born out of those communities and sub-communities born out of those communities and real-world action happening, not bringing on some guy talking about selling you a $9 million hole in the ground that you can never afford. In our space, you will see people starting farms, building homesteads, doing side hustles, starting their own podcast, doing their own thing on YouTube, or wherever it is, their own content creation business. You'll see people like Bo Botherington with Better Together Life, or Tim Toolman with the work that he's doing, or Nicole Sauce. And those are just people that are really close to us. There's people that were close and have gone off and done so well, we hardly ever see them anymore, but they pop in once in a while, like Charles the Humble Mechanic. That's the fruit. That's the fruit, is what is being said and done and modeled, creating action in the world that has meaningful impact? Or is it just to get eyeballs for today, and then you have to do the same thing tomorrow, and then you have to do it again, and then you have to do it again, and you're always looking for something else to hype? And that's why I asked the question I did at the beginning of today's show. Is there ever been a major impactful event that wasn't a false flag or a conspiracy for these people? And the answer is no. Even when they don't go all the way with it, they always clickbait it. They never just say, we're going to figure out what happened here. No, something's wrong. They have these caskets. They're so big they can fit four of you in them at once. Yeah, okay. I do not trust the establishment at all. I believe that Western culture is being systematically destroyed by people who are idiots, but I also know they're idiots, and they're nowhere near as hyper-competent as these people would lead you to believe, and here's why that's important. If you think they are, you get into this desperation, give up, always on the edge of your seat, waiting for it to happen mode. You become scared of the monster under the bed that you cannot describe. Which is how Stephen King wrote so many bestsellers. He never tells you what the monster looks like. He lets your own mind create it for you. Or you can accept that these people are largely incompetent and unfortunately have a lot of power. And you get on building your own life. That's what I suggest you do. That's all I got for you today. Hope you enjoyed it. Take care, and I will catch you tomorrow with Friday Flashback. Bail you out, just run you round. They said you should have a house. The American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a bed.